everybody. Welcome back to episode 13 of Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, bringing you part two of our series covering the 1999 murder of high school student Haemin Lee, whose ex-boyfriend and classmate, Adnan Syed, was charged for the crime and later convicted, despite a lack of physical evidence and mounting reports of neglect on behalf of his attorney, Christina Gutierrez. But first, I'd like to take a moment to thank everybody who's listened to the show so far, whether you loved it or hated it. I know some people think it's a lot of fun, while others want me to be the victim in my next episode. But either way, I really appreciate everybody's time, and have gotten some great feedback that will hopefully improve the show moving forward. Of course, feel free to hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There's also a contact form on the website, coldcasemurdermysteries.com. If you click into any of the posts, it automatically appears beneath them. And beyond that, what really makes me so thankful is that I went browsing the top 200 in the Society and Culture section on Apple Podcasts the other day, looking for something new to listen to, and I noticed this show was on the chart. It wasn't even at the bottom either. So this has really been a great experience for me, and it's because all of you had the generosity to give this a chance. As I write this, the show has been available for download less than 3 weeks, so it's been nothing less than amazing to have so many people embrace it. If you're a creator of anything, you know that the path to distribution is often blocked with men in suits who have no regard for anything but making money. But the game has changed. We can be heard. We can be seen. And we don't always need our worth validated by executives. If there was ever a time in human history to put yourself out there, to not be scared, that time is now. But I still get asked, aren't you afraid of what people think? Of what they'll say about you for these opinions you share? To that I can only say this. Someday there will only be silence. Forever. And the past does not echo through the cavernous voids of the universe. The past lives and dies in the human heart. It crumbles to dust in time. Within, there's a realization that we live entirely in service of the satisfaction of one profound moment, when our understanding and ignorance collide like two fast-moving trains. That's the moment of our last thought on Earth. The one we fear so greatly because we know that even if we do nothing but focus on our loved ones, and how fortunate we've been, the elephant in the room is this. Regret. We live a life that is simultaneously inspired to achieve and to fear, and our willingness to cross the boundary between the two destinations is what defines us as individuals, specifically our propensity for success or failure. But no matter what you believe, apathy is death. Silence is death. A lack of fear implies the same thing. All of the physical properties of being dead translate seamlessly when applied to the emotional context of experiencing the human condition when you won't act upon feelings of fear. Remember the parallels I mentioned in the previous episode? Always look for them. The entirety of the universe's secrets exists within your brain. It's intuitive. The failure is in trying to articulate the content beyond this notion. There's a beautiful truth that's unique to you. Use it. Basically, what I'm trying to say is, I just don't give a fuck. I choose to live. I choose to create, to be criticized, to be loved, hated, admired, and laughed at. It's beautiful. It's human. And it's what all of us should be doing every day. And finally, if you do like what you hear and you find a free moment, I'd be incredibly thankful if you could review the show. 5 stars are obviously appreciated, but 1 star is fine as long as it's constructive and helps me improve. So, with that said, let's jump into part two of this examination, in which we'll focus on one very important question that physical and circumstantial evidence was not able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, in many people's opinions. Of course, Hay was clearly murdered, specifically manually strangled, and her car abandoned. But what we really want to know is this. What happened in those 21 minutes right after Woodlawn High School let out for the day on the afternoon of January 13, 1999? Essentially, we have 3 camps we need to analyze in order to proceed in understanding how the crime transpired. The first is Adnan's claim that he can't remember. So, without entirely rehashing what we discussed in the last episode, it stands to reason that the basics of cognitive function dictate that he's lying because he has no context for a major life event that was not only immediately apparent to him in the hours after Hay's disappearance when people were calling him to learn if they knew anything. So, think about this. You're Adnan Syed, the only significant long-term romantic partner you've had in your young 17-year-old life to this point, has disappeared without a trace one afternoon. something which you would later label in an interview as something she would never do voluntarily because she had an obligation to being at a wrestling match to work as a scorer. So, how is it that you don't think something is wrong as soon as you begin getting calls from police? Of course, the first thing people are looking for in these calls is Adnan to divulge what he knows, if anything. So what do you do when people make such inquiries? You try to create context to fill in the pieces of the puzzle. For example, when did I last see her? What time was that? Where was that? If she was last seen at this time, where was I? Did she mention where she was going? What did I ask her? Did she mention anything else? You would jog your memory in an effort to be helpful. And let's be clear. It's total bullshit to give Adnan the benefit of the doubt because a greater period of time had elapsed before he talked to police and couldn't remember. He was aware of the circumstances from the start. Again, I hate to be repetitive, but this behavior runs parallel to what we get from Burke Ramsey when asked about the pineapple. He places the question in the context of when it's being asked most recently, rather than when the incident occurred, and asks us if we could remember eating pineapple on Christmas Day 20 years later. Adnan does the same in placing the innocence of his forgetfulness in the context of when he started getting grilled by police. But again, this is absolute nonsense. Think to your high school days and ask yourself this. If a popular girl you knew was mysteriously murdered, how much would you be talking about it? Maybe a better question is, would there even be another topic of conversation for days or even weeks, perhaps until graduation and beyond? And if you were the scorned ex-boyfriend of that girl, who just so happened to recently fall for another guy and leave you, would you not be aware of the importance of establishing your whereabouts during the crime because police would obviously be interested in you due to motive? Yet, Adnan maintains that he was surprised by the cop's suspicion, that he thought he was just giving them information. Until they produced a witness. More on that shortly. But for now, let's get real. Adnan says he can't remember those 21 minutes because it was just a normal day, like any other. But a cursory examination of these words renders them a lie. Here's why. The only thing he remembers about the afternoon of January 1399 is specifically this. The part that was like any other day. Meaning, everything that falls outside of the time frame of the murder and cover-up. But conversely, his coach can't remember if Adnan was at track practice that day. Though he has stated he doesn't have any reason to believe he wasn't. Now look at the situation again. The coach can't remember because this truly was like any other day for him. Undoubtedly, it's perfectly normal to be unable to account for the whereabouts of what I guess would constitute dozens of students on the track team. In this case, quantitative restrictions would reasonably prevent a person's brain from recalling the presence or absence of everyone in question. But notice the coach knows one very important thing. His own location at the time. For that, he had ample context, specifically because he was surrounded by people and interaction, and later learned that the major event had taken place. And that's the key here, because the same thing would be happening in the library at school, where Adnan now states he was after another student, Asia McLean, reported to have seen him there not only on the afternoon of the murder, but within the specific time frame police claimed the killing occurred, and the cover-up. So, Adnan latches onto this, because he sees it for what it is. She's throwing him a rope, a life preserver that would keep him afloat in his attempt to escape the ocean of despair and lifelong imprisonment. And she's throwing him this because that's what she's experiencing too. So are you. So am I. And the same goes for anybody who ever has or ever will take a breath on this earth. This is finding the adapter for your port, the strength for your weaknesses. We do it on a regular basis, in marriage, in business partnerships, in writing teams, in lineups on the field at sporting events, and everywhere we look. Everywhere. Everything complements something else, and there's an undeniable attraction between the opposing strengths and weaknesses of these people. That to which we are specifically attracted in these situations is balance. Because balance equates to what? Peace. We are all looking, suffering, yearning, reaching out our hands. And there is nothing more powerful, more electric, than the connection of adapter to port, of strength to weakness. This isn't the way some things work. It is not specific to love or hate or even lust. It is everything we are and everything we do. But in most circumstances, as opposed to murder, the adapter just serves as a symbolic representation of dominance, while the port is deemed more submissive. This is a perfectly natural order, as each is equally relevant and lacking balance in the absence of the other. And this is where Asia McClain becomes transparent in her dishonesty, specifically her corruption of these natural processes, which is entirely evident in her first letter to Adnan after the murder took place and he became a suspect. Here it is. Dear Adnan, in parentheses it reads, I hope I spelled it right. Of course, it's not spelled right. And right here I'm already hitting the brakes because she's telling me something loud and clear. She doesn't give a shit about factual accuracy. To the extent she's writing a jailed man a letter upon which his entire future could possibly hinge, and doing so under the pretense that she recalls the nuances of factual info that nobody else in the Woodlawn Library was able to muster on that particular day. In order to believe her, we need to understand why there isn't a large group of people making similar claims. The only possibilities are this. Either Asia possesses recall abilities in excess of nearly every other person who comes into her surroundings on a regular basis, or she sees the adapter for her port, for her weakness, for her need, for that feeling that never goes away. So she plugs into this, into importance, into exclusivity, into perpetual relevance. And as soon as I conjured that opinion, I immediately went online and searched for the simple phrase, one that I knew with absolute certainty was a reality. Asia McClain book. And there it was. But let's get back to the text of the letter, and why this is so shameful. She writes, quote, I'm not sure if you remember talking to me in the library on January 13th, but I remember chatting with you. Now, if you're Adnan, and you see this, if you're drowning, this is the rope. But how does he know it's real? How does he know it isn't a trap? Easy. She only needs to display her weakness, to identify herself as a port. And here it is. Quote, throughout your actions that day, I have reason to believe in your innocence. End quote. Okay. That's fair, as long as she can elaborate upon what these things constitute. But she can't. The best she can do is the following line where she goes on to write that she went to Adnan's house and explained his, quote, calm manner to his family, in reference, of course, to when she allegedly saw him in the library. But how is being calm related to committing a murder? If a sociopath commits murder, there's no justification required in his or her mind past the desire to do so, and therefore, there is no physical reaction to the implications of the event that just occurred, because making the decision to kill someone causes you the same distress as making a sandwich. Asia then goes on to say, quote, we aren't really close friends, but I want you to look into my eyes and tell me of your innocence. If I ever find otherwise, I will hunt you down and whip your ass. Okay, friend? This isn't the way you interact with a murder suspect, or even a high school student. I should say, even as a high school student. It's the way you interact with a guy who's out of your league. One that you want to like you. Because we all want to be wanted. And to be relevant. Of course, this letter was dated March 1st, more than 6 weeks after the crime. And the person writing it has waited to do so for a reason that is explicitly unavailable to us. So we should examine what that might be. Why did Asia wait? Well, she says she told the cops, and they didn't seem to respond in a manner that would suggest they were inclined to take action to learn more. Now let's fast forward that notion to Adnan's future attorney, Christina Gutierrez, who's been accused of neglecting her own notes suggesting Asia saw Adnan in the library that day. Lastly, let's add the fact that nobody outside of those accompanied by Asia McClain saw Adnan in the library that afternoon. Now, we could formulate any number of reasons why the police, and even the accused lawyer, would act in this neglectful manner, most of them conspiratorial in nature. But all of those possibilities, as feasible as they are, remain far less likely than this option. Adnan is lying, and the metaphorical implication is this. It's simple. those who are guilty are required to find the needle in the haystack to prove innocence. But those who are innocent merely have to point to the stack of hay. Because this much is true. The things we most staunchly deny are the ones we least want to acknowledge. And what is the only thing Adnan can't remember? Where he was when Haymin Lee was killed. Adnan Syed is the only person involved in this case who can't remember where he was when the victim lost her life. She was murdered by strangulation in the absence of sexual assault, robbery, or any motive other than this. Rejection. This is the most painful part of our evolutionary process. That which dictates we are constantly trying to ascend to something greater, whether it's having better looking or richer friends, getting a better job, or in this case, leaving behind those who no longer fit the mold of the direction our lives are taking. We grow out of things as adults, the same way kids do with their shoes, toys, and playmates. We switch cars, houses, lovers, clothes, and everything else we possibly can to find the balance that keeps us peaceful in the face of constant deterioration and inevitable death. Women leave their husbands for men with more money and security. Men leave their wives for somebody younger with more sex appeal. And so on. It never ends. These behaviors are not simply conducive to evolution. They are, by definition, evolution itself. Standing in the way of them is a recipe for disaster. It's a train barreling at you along the tracks while you dare it to hit you. Refusing to accept change, especially that which was not precipitated by your own desires, is an abomination of the evolutionary process. Those who engage in it pay an emotional price beyond what the human mind is equipped to face. The end result is that the person becomes enraged and must then kill evolution, specifically the change that precipitated the misery, in order to proceed in life. When we do this emotionally, we get slowly strangled to death and bury the burden of the emotional toll it takes on us. But when these matters are dealt with in a physical context, that's when it gets really scary. That's when we stop burying our feelings and start burying bodies. Because murder is simply this, an expression of evolutionary rage. Murder is therefore precipitated by only one thing, change. When you don't like what someone did, and the world is seemingly no longer the same in the aftermath, that person becomes symbolic as the deity which empowered the change. That person is God, evolution, eternity. And it reveals our greatest sadness. Lack of control. We are at its mercy. And this is what Adnan Syed did in those 21 minutes for which he cannot account. Very briefly, and in a minuscule sense in the grand scope of the universe, he stopped evolution in its tracks. He murdered time, potential, love. Adnan Syed murdered the future, plain and simple, because that's what he felt Hay did to him. She unplugged the cord, and the disconnection of that electricity, the loss of power, left Adnan alone in a dark room pondering his emptiness. It's the reason going to prison never seemed to upset him. He was already there. And that's the funny thing. Getting back to Asia McClain and how she's correlated to this idea. She's seeking the same thing Hay was seeking in getting away from Adnan and toward Don. Ascension. To something better. To someone better who would, by default of being with him, raise the perception of her own stock. Ascension is the essence of evolution, the truth in the brew boiling in the pot. And the bottom line in this process is this. When someone wins, somebody else loses. Somebody descends, rather than ascending. This is how we came to have the metaphorical implications of heaven and hell. It's the reason the open sky is above us, and the solid ground is below. Ascension is the game. Descending is death, darkness, burial. It's why we put our eternal spirits in the sky and our decaying bodies in the ground. All of these things are connected. Your only free will is to act within the parameters of the game. And that's what Asia McClain did. You see, She starts her claims about seeing Adnan in the library in the afternoon of January 1399, shortly after the crime. But for all intents and purposes, she gives up when the police don't follow up with her. Now, let's think about this and get back to the lurking parallels I told you to always consider. Asia gives up on trying to convince the cops pretty quickly because they don't believe her. Now, her next action, in the face of that, will reveal the motivation behind her actions. Basically, at this point, we have to believe she's come to the conclusion she won't get what she wants, and pushing the issue further will have no positive effect. So she quits. There's simply no ROI apparent, or she would move forward in making more attempts to be heard. But when we place this in the context of murder, and somebody's life wasting away in prison for a crime he didn't commit, her intensity of effort and lack of diligence doesn't match the motivation she's used as justification for her actions. Her half-assed effort says this: she was throwing out a rope to the police, in the same way she did with Adnan. It was bait. Adnan bit instantly because the symbiosis apparent in them helping each other is abundantly clear. They both want the same thing: ascension from an imprisoned existence. This is the parallel that drew Asia to Adnan. But as time passes, Asia goes from being adamant about Adnan's whereabouts on that day to growing up and not even thinking about him rotting away in prison. In fact, it got to the point that she would no longer speak about it, which means she was intentionally denying Adnan potential freedom. And what do you prevent somebody from doing when you restrict freedom? Ascending. Now, if you were sure you saw him in the library that day, it would eat at you forever in the form of little reminders emanating from the corners of your brain. That is, unless you'd been denied the opportunity for ascension by getting involved and felt that Adnan no longer had anything to offer within this realization. That's the next parallel. They no longer had anything to offer each other, so the distance between Asia and Adnan remained a wide gap for years. But then there was Serial. And boom! Asia McLean rises from the ashes right alongside Adnan. Partners once again, as she's now suddenly inclined to jump back on the bandwagon and toot the horn of innocence for Adnan for everybody to hear. But what drew her from darkness? From denial? Was it simply a phone call from a producer? No. It was this. Evolution. The potential to ascend. To be important. Relevant. And seen. To be something. Anything. To escape the loneliness. And make some fucking money. That's Asia McLean. That's you. It's me. It's a beautiful disease we call humanity. So you make a podcast. You write a book. You do interviews. You ascend. Because your worth is predicated upon your perceived evolutionary value. So, let's revisit this from a motivational standpoint years later. With Serial, Adnan finds some support and the hope of a new trial, while Asia promotes Adnan's innocence once again because now she stands to profit from the experience. But I'm here to tell you something that's a fact before it happens. This plan they've concocted to prove him innocent? It isn't going to work. And this is where we get to the reason I provided you with this silly analogy of adapter to port throughout these episodes. A cursory examination of this situation reveals that it's not clear who's the dominant party. In fact, it's fair to say that while the relationship between Adnan and Asia is clearly symbiotic in terms of motivational considerations, it's also apparent that both are weak, that both succumb to the desires of the other's attempted ascension, in service of a lie. So, the foundational basis for this moving forward becomes an inevitable clash of ideals. Now, think of that for a moment, and relate it to the incident in Serial where the narrator enthusiastically informs Adnan of Asia's intentions, and is then baffled when she can't understand why he doesn't seem more excited at the prospect. It's an obviously beneficial bit of news, but he rejects it like a child drinking cough syrup. And she can't believe it. And then strangely, Adnan doesn't even seem to be able to articulate why he feels this way. Well, the reason is this. His intuition has already informed him of this action being a failure because it's an abomination of the evolutionary process. So he begins his routine of talking circuitously in an effort to aptly define something that escapes definition past the point of being hardwired in the mapping of our brains. And this is why, in the previous episode, I told you to pay close attention to this moderate to above average intelligence and how it limits his ability to comprehend the greatest extent of self-awareness. He's sitting there in this interview, disappointed to the core about great news, and unable to articulate why he feels this way. It's baffling. He simply knows he feels it, so it must be the truth. The reason for this is that he's not intelligent enough to grasp these ideas on a macro level and then elaborate upon them in a manner conducive to understanding. So he keeps talking, and talking, and talking, which is what salesmen do when you don't want their product. Because when you're lying, and an interviewer knows it, that situation becomes the absolute pinnacle of quality journalism, which is leading a subject into a major revelation without ever asking the question, and then watching him drown in the resulting deluge of wasted words. The reason we know this is true is because our emotional lives operate within a dual system of currency that branches out from one place. Subtext. The subtext of our actions is utilized concurrently, and again, in a parallel manner, to display truth and lies for all to see. We lie with the disparity between our words and actions, and we also reveal truth in the same manner. Parallels, my friends. They're everywhere. The key to unlocking a universe is in your brain, and that makes you the most amazing and beautiful construction the world will ever know. And with it comes this parallel truth. We are also the world's greatest evil. This is you. This is me. This is Adnan's broken heart as he stares at the ceiling in bed late at night thinking about Hay while knowing she was thinking of her new boyfriend Don. This is that which is irreconcilable. It is darkness in search of light. That is all we are. Darkness in search of light. And as we evolve, we see the same in our expanding universe, which has only one function, as do we, turning darkness to light. In a human context, this means turning isolation and fear into love. But we need to look no further than our own inventions to see the truth. Light always dwindles to darkness in the end. The light bulb burns out. So does that star winking at you from above in the sky. And it's for this reason that some of us decide the best path is to jump from the windows of a burning building rather than suffer the wrath of its flames. Yet in these cases, we see only the illusory freedom of being able to fly during the fall, and not the finality waiting below when we land without a net. This is what happened to Adnan Syed. He ran to darkness, saw himself for what he was, and tried to turn back to the light. But it was too late. So, what exactly happened during those 21 minutes? I'm about to speculate, to a great extent, because this is where we have an absence of fact, and even an absence of relevant info, true or false, because while the cover-up of the murder involves a lot of controversial claims, the actual murderer is absent of any insight in the face of Adnan's staunch denial and the lack of detail he provided to acquaintances after the fact. So, this is where we introduce Jay. Now, in previous accounts of this story, Jay is basically painted as a good acquaintance of Adnan's, if not a casual friend, with whom his greatest shared interest is getting high. So, they do have something in common, and the fact that Jay also sold weed during this time gives them reason to be associated for that fact, even in the absence of a strong friendship. The bottom line, in terms of relevance, is this. Jay was a guy Adnan could approach about acquiring services related to things that were illegal. There isn't any reason beyond this consideration to wonder why Adnan chose Jay. Jay's everyday actions in life paralleled this specific desire: to be liked, accepted, and rewarded for providing illegal services offered in the absence of interference by the police. The degree to which he and Adnan are friends is irrelevant in the face of this parallel. Adnan did not choose Jay because he was more willing to engage in dangerous activity. That's a skin-deep observation plagued with fear and niceties that thinly disguise the truth. Which is this. Jay was a fucking loser. He was looking to ascend. He was desperate. He was weak. And Adnan's moderate to above-average intelligence predisposed him to believing this was true. And it was. But his lack of superior intelligence, and more specifically self-awareness of the limitations of his own intellect, simultaneously prevented him from seeing this hard truth. If Jay is weak and will join the team in favor of ascension, then he's going to do the same thing when the cops get to him. Because the situation is like this. For those of you familiar with the West Memphis 3 case, which I'm dying to cover, no pun intended, there are tremendous parallels. Jay is basically Jesse Miss Kelly with more brain power, and he's going to give an admission to a crime that's seemingly genuine in presentation, but plagued with inaccuracy and lies to an extent that it leaves your head spinning. Where that gives us an advantage in our analysis, however, is that we aren't burdened by the confines of strict logic in our assessment. We can speculate, and nobody's life is altered as we proceed in this. But before we proceed, I want to point out Adnan's ultimate downfall, aside from the obvious fact he took somebody's life. And it's another reason parallels are so important in our analysis. Because when you follow the trail of parallels to the end of the line in any situation, whether it's positive change or murder, the one thing you'll find is that the moment the parallels cross lanes and collide, closing the circuit, there is one imminent event that defines the onset of change. Tragedy. You see, all change is inspired by the disunity of strong desire and poor logic. Succumbing to the change inspires realization, hope, and possibility, while resisting it is a one-way ticket to your death with no stops along the way. That could be construed in an emotional or physical context, but this produces the finest of dramatic material and retellings. It's the stuff of Shakespeare. And the reason is very specific. Tragedy is the result of acting against your own interests while in ignorance of the truth. So, what caused Jay to swerve across lanes and run Adnan off the road to end the parallels and close the circuit? How was Adnan so badly fooled about Jay's loyalty when he had already convinced Jay to get involved to an extent there was no turning back without serious consequences? Well, the answer to this can be summarized in three words. Jay's words. Quote, I feel bad. You see, as I've already stated, Adnan is a sociopath and has no regard for the crime he committed in terms of the atrocity against humanity. To him, he was simply, and quite literally, disposing of a problem. His assumption, because of Jay's willingness to participate, is that Jay felt the same way about it. So what spurred this tragedy, Adnan's downfall, is the fact that Jay has a conscience. And Adnan was unable to recognize that fact because he's not equipped to comprehend by default of a logic unique to his thoughts and motives. And that's how it happened. The cops asked Jay why he came forward. And for any criticism of their work outside of this consideration, this is one place where they certainly shine. Because Jay is a character who is prone to lying. And the basis for lying is to protect oneself from implication in any type of wrongdoing, whether perceived or factual. But here they aren't asking a question that could be damning to Jay. They're asking him to tell them why he's a good person, even in spite of his actions. And they already know it's because he couldn't live with it. But it's a massive revelation of the truth, of what really transpired, when Jay just keeps repeating, I feel bad. Because this is how we got the term straight shooter, by somebody saying only what he or she means. And this is the only place in this case, in any of Jay's interviews, where he exposes the truth without concern for protecting himself. He doesn't try to talk his way out of involvement, even if he lies about the details. We have to remember that he actually implicates himself in the cover-up by supplying the shovels, giving Adnan a ride, and wiping fingerprints off those shovels. And here I'll jump right to the next parallel to prove Jay is telling the truth. We have to ask ourselves this. At the conclusion of Jay's involvement that evening of murder, what's the first thing he did? he told his friend Jen Pusateri that Adnan killed Hay. And it's here that many people start to wonder if he's just trying to point blame away from himself. But that's not the case. This statement is just a jumping-off point for Jay to tell her his involvement, which he eventually does. And what does he do next, even according to her? He asks Jen if he should go to the police. Now, if you just helped somebody cover up a murder, or even if you committed it yourself and wanted to lie, either of those activities could cost you your life in prison, if not worse. But Jay is already inquiring about this. And also, according to Jen, he's pretty badly shaken up. Yet every account of Adnan that evening is that he seemed to be acting normally. And it's because one of these people is a sociopath. Of course, this is where the parallel ended. When Jay realized he had a conscience and veered out of Adnan's lane, closing the circuit and moving on to conspire with the cops, who realized his weakness and offered him their help. In the end, this symbiosis allowed Jay to relieve his conscience and avoid severe criminal charges, while the cops were able to jail their suspect. Adnan's sociopathic tendencies derailed the notion that this circuit would close, and for one very specific reason. And here's the next parallel. The manner in which Adnan resisted change by murdering Evolution in the form of Heyman Lee when she closed the circuit on their romance is the exact reason he was ultimately brought down by Jay right after the crime. He didn't recognize the circuit was going to close after their purpose together, the murder, was complete. So he was a sitting duck from the start. The only way he could have gotten away with this crime is to implicate Jay, or to kill Jay as well. He needed to be the one to end the circuit with Jay, to initiate change. Instead, he expected Jay to keep this brutal, senseless murder of an innocent girl a dark secret in his heart forever. It did so for the simple fact that he's a cold-hearted son of a bitch who doesn't have one. So, now he sits in prison, seemingly not even too bothered by it. And the reason is this. Nothing ever changes there. And if justice is served, nothing ever will. But how do we explain away Jay's lies and inconsistencies? I mean, he first said he saw the body in the trunk of Hay's car when Adnan showed it to him at Best Buy, as Jen Pusateri claims. Yet Jay told a different story, at least at first. Yet, by his second interview with police, he tells them the same thing he told Jen, that the murder happened at Best Buy, and that Adnan called him from a payphone there, one that nobody can seem to establish as actually being there aside from architectural plans showing a vestibule for a phone booth in the building's front entrance. And then there's the cell phone evidence. Jay claims to have been in possession of Adnan's phone and car the afternoon of the murder. And inconsistencies regarding the validity of incoming call information has become the centerpiece of the push to get Adnan a new trial, which appears imminent, even with the process moving at a snail's pace. So, for me, Jay is the most baffling character here, one that actually warrants less analysis simply by default of that fact, because what he's protecting is spawned by a logic singular to a motivation he's conjured in his mind, and undoubtedly it parallels his desire to be involved in the murder to begin with. There's an undertone throughout his interviews that suggests the cops are more interested than suspicious in trying to discover why he's lying, specifically because the benefit of doing so, and the manner in which he's doing it, only seem beneficial to the inspiration of this singular logic, and have no correlation to getting in trouble. For instance, why lie about the body being in the trunk in a certain location, when what's actually causing you trouble is the fact you were involved in the cover-up of a murder in which you've already admitted your own involvement? But at heart, no matter what Jay believes his motivation might be, the answer is that he's catering to perception in a situation where he's the sole owner of important information and how it's going to be distributed. He's in power. And despite the fact I just said Jay was baffling, in that same regard, he's not. Jay was simply doing this. He was fucking with the cops. He was in control. And there it is, the tie that bound Jay and Adnan. Control. The murder occurred when Adnan lost control. Jay extended his interviews and mysterious presence while peppering the cops with lies because his leverage in the situation His control of knowing what they didn't was like an hourglass emptying to nothingness right in front of his eyes. So he created more questions. He confused timelines. He played dumb and offered misdirection at every turn. And it parallels the same tragedy we just mentioned. Because when it's over, Jay descends back to irrelevance. That's how sad and desperate we are. All in the pursuit of our 15 minutes. In the pursuit of meaning. In the pursuit of love. The one journey where we all lose control. And find ourselves again. The one place where we live, learn, and most importantly, change. This is what Haemin Lee wanted from her life. What was taken from her. And this is how it happened. So let's dive into a complicated mystery here. One rife with questions of possibility, plausibility, and a general sense of nobody knows what the hell happened in those 21 minutes beyond the fact that Hay was strangled to death by somebody in her car. So I'll speculate about how I think the murder actually occurred, and then examine those suspicions in the light of what takes place next. Now, we know a couple of people overheard Adnan asking Hay for a ride after school in the afternoon of January 13th. But these same people did not witness him getting in her car. And while Asia McLean insists she saw Adnan that day in the library, Adnan himself actually admits he did ask Hay for a ride earlier in the day, but didn't take it. Now, we could easily give Adnan the benefit of the doubt, but he simply does not fucking deserve it, people. If you ask somebody for a ride after school, and the person then ends up dead without evidence of whom the murderous passenger might have been, the most likely candidate in the absence of another viable suspect over the course of nearly two decades is guess who? The dude she broke up with 1 week earlier, whose heart was broken and is the only person reported to have potentially been in the vehicle or requested to have been given access on that afternoon. So I'd like to proceed, for our purposes, under the assumption that Adnan Syed was the person responsible for murdering Hay in her car. If that is the case, the first thing to establish is the manner in which Adnan would had to have had to act in order to prevent himself from becoming suspicious and endangering his intentions. So, in this light, the obvious point of engagement is Adnan approaching Hay under the false pretense that he needs a ride. But with consideration for the restrictions of her own agenda and schedule as time passes and the events unfold. So, this ride Hay agreed to give Adnan was actually set up by his earlier actions right after their breakup, when she called him to come to the scene when she was concerned her car was disabled and unsafe to drive. While there, Adnan was cordial to Hay's new boyfriend, Don, and by all accounts, there were no problems. But after what we just discussed, specifically Adnan's sociopathic behavior, this is clearly not an indication he's resigned himself to losing her to Don and moved on. Rather, and quite chilling, I believe his calm presentation here was in the fact that he was already at peace with the solution he was going to implement. Looking at this car in the face of her boyfriend wasn't even the least bit humiliating. It was necessary. Clinical. In the same way her murder occurred. So, here we are. We're in Hay's car leaving Woodlawn High School. And it's seriously a blank slate from here. I mean, anything could have happened. But this is my intuition. I think Adnan initially suggested a drop-off point to Hay before they departed, as you would any time you get a ride from another person. Except the reason for going there was a fabrication. And I think that location, by default of his motive, was somewhere more remote, and perhaps a farther drive than Hay had intended to give with her tight schedule. It likely involved her going along with something shady, and even if she didn't recognize it for what it was, she was certainly reluctant to get late getting to her own destination. And I believe that's how we end up with the crowded Best Buy parking lot only 1 mile away from the school as the murder scene. I mean, if I really had to put my chips on one scenario, I would guess that Adnan's original intention was to get her to Leakin Park to commit the murder, thereby being able to easily dispose of the body in the intended location without transporting it. And I think what makes this scenario likely is that with the ride from Hay being so short, and without any specific reason for believing Best Buy as the planned destination, it seems as though Adnan's plans could have been rerouted by Hay's reluctance, and he told her to drop him off there when that scenario didn't work. They'd reportedly used the park as a place to have sex in the past, and Adnan might have been under the impression he could still lure Hay into doing so. So, from here, as they arrive at Best Buy, I think Adnan panicked. It was a now or never situation for him. He was desperate to kill her, and had to find the balls to act in broad daylight in a crowded parking lot. And here's why. The greatest change between two people when a romantic relationship ends is often considered to be the lack of physical contact. But another thing that's equally absent from this situation is this. Being alone together. You see, Hay was becoming wrapped up in her relationship with Don, and her dealings with Adnan were going to dwindle in number until he became an afterthought. So he had to act quickly. During the last days, he had intimate access to her life in a manner that wouldn't leave him trying to kill her on school grounds or anywhere else in public, for that matter. This was his last shot at that, for all intents and purposes. So, the one thing that baffles me, however, is how he got her to pull the car into a parking space at the store, rather than just drop him off in front of the place. I mean, he would have to have an excuse to keep her there with him, as though he was meeting somebody under the guise the person might not show and he would need a ride back. Or he would need a ride back even if the person showed. That's definitely a strong possibility, that he asked her to wait with him because it would only be a minute before the person he was going to meet arrived. Now, we do know that he was in search of weed later that day, and Jay did not have any. So it's very plausible that, as we know, at 3:59 p.m., they called their friend Patrick for weed, that he explained this to Hay, and to a certain extent, it was the truth. But then it hits me. Jay wasn't at school during this time. What Adnan did once he got in the car was ask Hay to give him a ride down the street to the Best Buy parking lot to meet Jay in order to buy weed. That is why she was inclined to cooperate. Teens pulling over in a public parking lot to buy weed from other teens is about as common as people going to the store for bread and milk. And it happens quickly. But most importantly, what it does is it sets the stage for Adnan to behave in a strange manner without Hay noticing. What do I mean by this? Check it out. If you were going to murder a person sitting in a car with you, that person would instantly become suspicious by your shady actions as your intentions started to reveal themselves. But if you went to a parking lot with somebody to buy weed, and he was looking all around him to be sure everything was cool and he wasn't being watched, you wouldn't be concerned that he was doing so in service of trying to bring harm to you. In fact, you would think the opposite, that his heightened awareness was indicative of his concern for your well-being and not getting caught doing something illegal. So, in this light, Adnan almost seems chivalrous for his actions. Hay is doing him a favor, and he's repaying her by taking precautions to be sure she stays out of trouble. At least, that's her perception of the events. And what does that mean? It means she was relaxed, off guard, and vulnerable. Beyond that, if there was anything of which she might be suspicious, under the guise of buying pot, it would be a threat coming from the outside of the car, either in the form of a cop or the person selling the drugs. So, where can we assume Hay's attention is upon arrival? Outside the car. And where is the focus of Adnan's rage? Inside the car. Hay got caught by surprise. He pounced on her. There wasn't an argument that spun out of control. There was no fight in the confines of the vehicle. He smothered her instantly with his body, pinning her left arm against the inside of the driver's door, while her right arm was trapped between their bodies. So what ensued from there is that she couldn't fight back with any degree of significance that would get her out of trouble. She couldn't call for help. She was suffering. So, what did she do in the absence of being unable to fight back? She let go. She let it happen. This is actually a somewhat common occurrence in murder victims, since they have lived lives, as we all have, that have taught them that every terrible experience ends in time. They welcome the end in favor of the suffering. And that's how I believe Haman Lee died. Alone. Suffocating. Staring into the eyes of evil and watching her reflection mirrored from its empty soul. It's horrifying, sad, and inhumane to an extent that I have no words that could suffice in trying to justify their purpose. No. For this, I have only silence. And so should Adnan Syed for the rest of his life. Trapped. Alone. Suffocating. With nowhere to run. Until he takes his last breath and leaves this world with wide eyes screaming the fear of what comes next. Just like the way he left Haemin Lee. And on that note, what about Hay, for whom there will be no second chance at freedom that will seemingly be afforded Adnan, and for whom fame and recognition has come at the premature loss of her life, and at the hands of a killer? Well, the one thing she left us was this. Her words. In fact, one sentence. It was something she wrote to Adnan in her last letter to him. A note written right after their breakup and just before her death. And it speaks volumes to the truth you and I discussed here today. Those words, quote, "I really did expect you to accept, if not understand." And the incredible beauty in Hay's wisdom, in this profound statement that perfectly encapsulates the fleeting nature of love and all of its endless repercussions, is that she didn't just leave those words for Adnan. She left them for all of us. For all of the things we'll never understand, but feel in our being. This was her intuitive connection to the world, to the universe that is common to our collective conscience as humans. Her words are the adapter to the port of our hearts. And within the electricity of that connection is something we call life, something we call change, and the courage to let love roam freely through it all.